Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Stock Club is brought to you by Hyundai. Restart your journey towards a greener world with Hyundai's next generation of zero-emission cars. Find out more about their range of electric vehicles and the savings they can bring to your company and employees at Hyundai.ie. Hi there, and welcome to the Stock Club podcast. I'm James, and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor, Emmett Savage, and our head analyst, Rory Caron. In this episode, we're talking about the effects a vaccine rollout will have on the market, why we're so annoyed that Salesforce has bought Slack, and our favourite bricks and mortar companies, including this month's Stock of the Month. So before we start today's episode, I just want to mention that this is actually my first day back in the office after taking a few days of annual leave. So all the planning for this episode was left in the hands of Emmett and Rory. As such, I'm recusing myself of all responsibility for how this episode goes. If you have any complaints, you can find both Emmett and Rory on Twitter.
Wait until this is the best episode, yes.
Yeah, it's going to be unruly. It's going to be shooting from the hip. It's just going to be so natural. It's going to be better, basically.
Rory, I anticipated you saying that. And if it's the best episode, I think you could probably claim it was the solid foundation I've laid over the last 2 years that has nurtured you guys to the point where you can plan an episode by yourselves. All right, let's move on before anyone gets insulted. So we'll start off with some good news today. On Monday, Margaret Keenan became the first patient in the world to receive the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. This represents some real light at the end of the tunnel for the world in what has been a very, very tough year. And it also marks the completion of an incredible global effort to tackle the coronavirus pandemic. However, I think my favourite part about the whole thing was the fact that as soon as it came out that Margaret was originally from Ireland, the whole of the country was suddenly like, yes, we did it. We've cured coronavirus. You're welcome. There's no other country, I think, in the world like Ireland that will claim credit so tangentially for something. What do you guys think?
Oh, I don't know. I can think of one.
Well, we did. We cured it, right? This really funny tweet floating around at the moment, which I'm sure most people have seen at this stage, about what is Bill Gates going to do now that he has control of his first... you know, 90-year-old, you know, granny.
Yeah, exactly. Well, of course, off the back of this news, the stock market jumped and it's touching new all-time highs again. I suppose we were to expect this, Rory.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, like, the market's just doing its thing for any good news at the moment. It's like, if it's not vaccine hopes, it's stimulus hopes. So, yeah, look, the narrative has become a bit tired at the moment.
Yes.
You know, every single day is another hope springs eternal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose we should point out as well that the vaccine has just begun rolling out in the UK. It's still to begin rolling out in the US. And I assume, Emmett, when the FDA finally do approve Pfizer's vaccine or somebody else's vaccine, we'll see another bump in the market again.
Mm. I think what we're going to see is a glut of vaccines. So there'd be no problem with access to approved vaccines for virtually anyone in the world in a very short time period. I think... I think the response to knowing that vaccines are available will be a little more muted because the world has still got to get their heads around how we're going to adjust. I think in the year ahead, mask wearing is going to become more normal than it ever has been to this point. For example, the way it is in many Asian countries. I think we're going to continue to see fewer business trips, more remote working going on like forevermore. I don't think 2021 will necessarily be the year for concerts or sporting events. You know, I just don't think it's going to get there just yet. And then I think scientists and doctors are going to have to learn about the efficacy and effectiveness of vaccines when they're out there. So there's still so many unknowns. How will the market respond? I would go with cautious optimism. I think that we're at a juncture now where we can see that this is going to come to an end, but it's not going to be binary. It's going to be a slow, steady, I suppose, revert to normal.
Yeah, and you said revert to normal there, and that actually tees up my next question perfectly. You know, we talk about the end of this pandemic, and, you know, it looks very likely now that the pandemic will end in the next few months, if not year. But that, I suppose, doesn't necessarily mean going back to a normal or going back to, you know, where we were this time 12 months ago. I've asked you guys this question before, but I'm curious to kind of get your updated answer on this. You know, to what degree do you think things will return to bunny ears normal? And what do you think are the things that have changed irreversibly and will never go back the same? Rory, I might come to you first.
Yeah, there's a quote that's often attributed to Lennon, but I actually think it was Scott Galloway, the Scottish MP, who said, "Nothing can happen for decades, and then decades can happen in weeks." That certainly is what it feels like.
Did you just quote Lennon on a podcast about the stock market?
Yeah, look, I'm all for the crushing yoke of unchecked capitalism, but now and again I can pull out an old Marxist quote. And as I said, it was wrongly attributed to Lennon, James. Please listen. So where I see things, you know, I don't think that we are going to return to a normal. I think we're going to progress. You know, I think we've talked multiple times about, you know, the big leap forward that we've taken with the coronavirus. E-commerce has leapt forward 10 years. I don't think that's going to reverse. I think, you know, we look at the indexes and we see that the stock market is way up, but I think the index is often misleading. Those gains have accumulated to a few large firms, particularly the likes of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, the big five. When we come back, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of businesses that are still going to struggle to recover. We're going to end up in a world where there's more foliage and fewer elephants. There'll be a lot of consolidation, I think. You know, there'll be a lot of bigger firms starting to buy smaller ones up with increasing frequency. And, you know, that's just a function of, you know, people want... There's an element of, we don't want to do this alone anymore. We're seeing a big rush of companies going public, either through IPO or SPAC. Founders and stakeholders are like, you know what, we don't want another March 2020. That was a very scary, worrying time for everyone, you know. And, you know, what's the future hold? You know, when billions of dollars are on the line, I think the mood has definitely changed in terms of the amount of risk people are willing to take on personally. You know, I think they want to spread that risk around a lot. And company, like the pricing companies has just gone crazy as well. Like companies are now being priced on their 10-year vision, which is handy for us because that's how we look at businesses. But like, you know, I know the argument against valuing Tesla as a car company, but like, let's consider for a second, Tesla is now worth more than Toyota, Volkswagen, Daimler and Honda combined.
Wow.
Tesla is going to produce about 400,000 cars this year. Those other four are going to produce 26 million. So that's the way the company's being valued now. It's not being valued today. It's being valued at what's it going to look like in 10 years. And that's all about vision. And the companies that are able to sell a vision are going to be the ones that are going to do well in this particular market. I think telemedicine is going to be accelerated. I think Teladoc's a great business to be in right now. That was, insurance was always a bit reluctant to embrace that model, but you know, that's definitely going to become a bunny ears new normal. Print and TV advertising, I think, is going to have a tough time recovering, which is good news for Google and Facebook. So there is going to be a lot of changes. I don't think this idea of going back to anything is what's going to happen. I think we're going to move forward to kind of a version of where we are now. I think there's still going to be a lot of social distancing issues. You know, like Emmett mentioned, we don't know the efficacy of these vaccines. We don't know how long immunity lasts. SARS immunity lasts 2 years. So that's a kind of good model to kind of think about. But again, we know so little. But yeah, I think, you know, work from home is going to be a big thing as well. I this is our new normal, really. You know, that's the thing I think people need to understand.
Absolutely. And Emmett, what about you? What do you think are the things that will never revert back to what we experienced 12 months ago?
Mm. Well, it's kind of funny. Like, so the virus, as we I think we all know, won't go away completely. So as we've discussed so many times before, remote working is the norm. And as Rory said, this, what we're doing now is the new normal. And for me, it raises the question of working from anywhere, which in turn raises the issue of pay balancing based on where you live. And I, for example, like a software engineer working for like a company, let's say EA Games in Redwood City or San Francisco, wherever they are, is probably paid more than a software engineer working for EA Games doing the exact same job in Bilbao City in Spain.
Yeah.
And what that kind of implies to me is that in 5 years, will software engineers, just to choose a specific profession, be working from anywhere? And therefore, will there be a kind of global rebalancing of a workforce, you know, as to where people want to work? And this will have a knock-on effect on rents and wages and all the hidden forces we accept today as normal. And what I mean by that is we three here on mic would perfectly accept that someone doing our job might be on double our salary if they're living in the middle of San Francisco City because that's where they live. I just think in 5 years' time from now that that will be a less acceptable outcome. I think companies are going to have to think hard that if someone rang in and said, hey, guess what, I'm moving from San Fran to Madrid, that that business basically cannot clip that person's wages. Yeah. So I just wonder how it's all going to play out. I think that is going to be one of the outcomes. And it's quite, I'm sure, a complex economic algorithm to figure how that's going to go. But I see that as emerging as one of the side effects of working from anywhere, which, as you said, Rory, is our new norm. This is the new norm.
Yeah, absolutely. And that raises another interesting question, Emmett, which is about these decentralized workforces and the idea that companies don't need these massive campuses like Facebook and Apple and Google all have. I know you've been interested in a few kind of property management companies and REITs in your research for Horizon. Has your opinion on those types of companies changed? I know the New York, the Empire State Trust was one of them you were looking at.
Empire State Realty Trust, ERST, was one I was looking at, and it basically seemed to be suppressed down to life. Well, it was down to $5 and change, and this REIT was about 26 bucks at an all-time high, and it basically, in buying a share in this REIT, you're owning a piece of the Empire State Building and a whole bunch of surrounding skyscrapers and commercial real estate in New York City and a little bit further afield. And, you know, there was an argument. So it wasn't an argument. It was plain to see that people were not going into the office spaces. And I think the number I read is 6 million people crush into New York City every day and then go home on the train. And, you know, this whole behavior, when you stop and look just now, suddenly seems to be less relevant or less important. So Empire State Realty Trust, as you mentioned, appeared to me to be synthetically too low. It's not that that building, iconic building, is going to disappear and it's going to have a zero utility. And I think it's rebounded up to like 10 bucks a share. So it was a pretty good investment just before the announcement of a vaccine, which we all saw or felt was inevitable. But there's so many different types of REITs that you can go in on, and they aren't just commercial real estate in the middle of cities. You can buy REITs in hospitals, you can buy REITs in schools, you can buy REITs in hotels, or even in adjacent, you know, industries to do with growing marijuana. So there's a lot of different REITs out there. But I still have a degree of caution on REITs concerned with getting people together to work.
Yeah.
You know, with the exception, of course, of hospitals and schools where people must go. But on other ones, I'm still, the jury is still out, as they say.
Absolutely.
Quick shout out to, I just read Scott Galloway's new book, which is actually called Post-Corona. So if anyone's kind of interested in some ideas on what Corona, the world's going to look like post-Corona, it's a good one to pick up.
Absolutely. Mm. Let's move on from good vaccine news then to more sad news for investors, at least. Last week was announced that Salesforce is set to acquire Slack in a cash and stock deal worth close to $28 billion. This is an acquisition that had been rumoured for a couple of days before the announcement, and it looks pretty certain to complete considering the close relationship between the two companies. Rory, I know you were pretty annoyed to see this deal happen, despite the nice premium we got at our position in Slack.
Yes, I know investors get excited when they see a company they own get acquired because, you know, seeing your stock rise 60% in the space of a few days is nice. It's nice to make a quick buck, I suppose, but like, I hate when companies are acquired from under us. I really do. When we add companies, we think about them with a 10-year outlook. So, you know, and I used the example of Ellie Mae before. You know, Ellie Mae was a mortgage origination software that we had in the app. Was it 2 years ago at least now? It got bought private by a company called Thoma Bravo for about $3.6 billion. And they sold it about like less than 18 months later for $11 billion. So like we really got us...
got screwed.
Yeah, for want of a better term. So that's one I always think about. But I think about other companies like Mazer Robotics, Mindbody were two great ones that we had in the app that got bought out from under us. And I saw Slack, you know, thinking about Slack from 10 years from now, there was a huge opportunity there, a lot more than what we're getting with the $27 billion from Salesforce. The debate over Slack was always, you know, is it a chat client or is it an operating system? And at the moment, like in its current iteration, it is mostly a chat client, but it's being valued like that. But yeah, definitely the opportunity, like due to the integration of thousands of the applications, it has the opportunity to be an operating system. And, you know, think about the way that software used to be delivered, used to be licensed, used to be a major investment, and all that had to work on a local operating system, something like Windows or iOS. Today, that's not how software is delivered. It's hosted in the cloud. It's immediately trialable, you know, usually for free. It exists oftentimes kind of siloed among specific teams within an organization, and it's incredibly diverse. You can get some sort of software to pretty much do anything. And, you know, we know all about those in this business, definitely. So the ability to harness the power of all those applications in one place was like an opportunity of untold fortunes, if you ask me. It was the future of how business was going to be conducted, not just within organizations, but across organizations. And Slack had the ability to be that. And that's where I saw the value in Slack. I believe that's where the investment opportunity was. And what's mad is that Salesforce saw it too. Like the CEO did say during the presentation, I quote, "This is the operating system for the new way to work." And if that's true, then they're getting an absolute deal. Like they are getting an absolute, they're stealing this from under us. Not that Slack didn't have its problems. Look, Microsoft Teams was a major hurdle for them, not just in terms of the pricing, the way they bundled it with 360 for free, essentially, but like, but also in terms of Microsoft's relationship with vendors. They just had great distribution. You know, 20 years of free shrimp cocktails is a hard hurdle for a new player to get over. so like it's going to be a lot fairer fight now between Slack and Teams, but I really did like the kind of David versus Goliath thing we got set up there. I was hoping to kind of watch that play out over a number of years and see where the two landed, because I had money on Slack and now I don't, sadly.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, Rory. Like if you stand back then, maybe from away from an investor's point of view and just as a kind of analyst's point of view, does it make sense for Salesforce to take Slack like this? You know, obviously it's their big play against Microsoft. CEO Mark Benioff is a vocal critic of Microsoft.
Mm. Yeah, look, it does make sense. I mean, from Salesforce's point of view, going through the presentation that they gave after the announcement, they see it the way I see it. It's this is going to be the front-facing part of Salesforce's offering to people. And in terms of, you know, enterprise software, Microsoft's obviously the big daddy. Google was, you know, a challenger, and Salesforce is now going to be a proper challenger because they are, I mean, they're all coming at it from different angles. Microsoft's from the productivity standpoint. Google is from the kind of integration standpoint with the internet, and then Salesforce obviously from the sales and customer facing standpoint. So now they've got a really good built with love top level, top stack for that entire ecosystem of applications they have. And, you know, I can see them doing really interesting things with it. Like Salesforce has the opportunity to make Slack free, not just a freemium version, completely free, and Sales and Slack Connect to be free. That will really make people like Google and Microsoft start getting worried. So it's a fairer fight now. I still think the company is going to be great. I think Salesforce will realize that value that we hope to realize. And it's going to become very interesting to see how Salesforce, Microsoft and Google continue to battle it out over the next 5-10 years.
So as part of this deal, Slack shareholders will get close to an eighth of a share in Salesforce, as well as about $27 in cash. Emmett, Slack was a position in the Horizon portfolio that you manage. Are you happy to become a Salesforce shareholder, or will you have to rethink about your holdings now after this deal?
Well, I've always admired Salesforce, and it's you know, you go through your investing life and you always talk, you kind of lament the ones you missed, and I kind of have repeatedly lamented Salesforce, and now it's being thrown on my lap. I so choose, I have to actually take an action to not be a Salesforce shareholder. So how it's played out for me and Horizon is I'm getting all the cash I invested in Slack back plus some, plus a slug of Salesforce shares, which effectively is tantamount to a full position for me in the service. But anyway, I'm still considering really what route to take. And as I said to Horizon subscribers, I many years ago, I invested in Marvel, the superhero guys. And along came Disney and bought Marvel with cash and shares, just the way Salesforce has bought Slack with cash and shares. And if I can't, I recall the feeling of the decision, you know, like you're looking at Disney, which was a powerhouse, an indisputable leader in the entertainment industry. And I very much feel it's the exact same type of decision now. There's an indisputable leader in the B2B space. And if I'd have to go back in my records, but I think I sold my Disney shares when they bought Marvel with cash and shares. And then they came along again and bought Pixar, which I was also a shareholder in, with the exact same deal, which was cash and shares. And it kind of felt like the universe was trying to orientate me towards being a Disney shareholder. However it went for me, and I'd have to check my records, as I say, I am up tenfold on my Disney shares, which were placed into my brokerage account without me having to take an action. And I today believe it's one of the greatest investments, and will remain so for the rest of my life. So the parallels for me are very strong. I think Salesforce, I suppose the analogy is Salesforce is analogous to the, it is the Disney of B2B software.
Yeah.
Like it is the giant, it is the dominant force. And as Rory explained, I mean, they have suddenly opened the door to businesses like My Wall Street, which up until now were not, and are not, Salesforce customers. And all of a sudden this land and expand model that we've spoken about on the podcast before is like supercharged for Salesforce. They're suddenly in, I can't remember, I think they have 12 million daily active users. So they've suddenly bought 12 million professionals' attention for a large part of their working day. And that will inevitably lead to better things for the business. So to your question, I'm not sure yet. Salesforce doesn't necessarily fit all the attributes I look for in investment. Most notably, it's so big right now.
Yeah.
The question is, can it 10x from here? And well, yes, it can. It's not beyond the realms of possibility. So I'm just thinking about it, James. I'm not happy with the acquisition, but it's not an awful outcome. I think that Salesforce paid well. Like they really wrote a big check. So I think we're doing okay.
I think you made a good point there as well, as those 12 million new customers, they're probably customers Salesforce wouldn't have had before, as they largely deal with bigger clients. Here's one question for both of you, just to finish off this part. What's the best company that's been bought out from underneath you like this? Rory, you mentioned Ellie Mae already. Was that the best company that got bought out from underneath you?
It's a tough one. Mazer Robotics was one that I think we really got screwed on, James, for your to use your term.
Yeah. What about you, Emmett? You mentioned Marvel.
Exactly the same. I think Mazor Robotics, I was a shareholder as well. They were the mini Intuitive Surgical, focused on a different procedure entirely. I think it was spinal surgery and injuries, and they had such a patent book and technology that worked. And I was very disappointed because I really think it was all set to go on to bigger and better things.
Absolutely. Let's move on then. And we've spoken already about some of the things that will never go back to the way they are thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic. And it seems like cinema is definitely going to be one of those. On Monday of this week, Warner Brothers announced that all of its 2021 film roster, including the massively anticipated blockbusters like The Matrix 4 and Dune, they'll all stream on HBO Max on the same day that they hit cinemas. The company said that this one-year plan was a response to unprecedented times of the outbreak, but it's unclear exactly how the excitement and the exclusivity of theatrical releases will ever be recovered from this. Rory, I know you've a lot of thoughts on this. What do you think? Is this the kind of death blow for cinema?
Just moving away from the cinema side of it briefly, like the background of this story is amazing. So there's a New York Times article about this if anyone wants to read. Warner Brothers approached last month two of the biggest talent agencies in Hollywood, William Morris Endeavor and Creative Artists, with the idea of releasing Wonder Woman 1984 on their streaming service, HBO Max. And this was a pretty kind of tense negotiation because both agencies, one represents Gal Gadot, the star of the movie, the other represents Patty Jenkins, the director. So the big question was, okay, how are you going to pay our clients if you're not getting this big box office release? And so a kind of tense negotiation ended with Warner agreeing that both those people would receive over $10 million, according to people familiar with the deal. So this is who spoke on anonymity and all that jazz. Last week, when the company announced that 17 other movies would be released in a similar way, they basically told no one. There was no negotiations. There was no talking to representatives. People were alerted about 90 minutes before the announcement.
Wow.
So now some of the biggest talent in Hollywood is feeling pretty burned. And a lot of questions are going to be asked about, like, how are we going to pay these people? Because the way the cinema or the film industry works is you have a guaranteed fee. And then there's, whether if the film's a mass success, you get a lot of money. If it's a flop, you kind of don't get that much money. So now the question is, how are you going to measure this? How are you going to switch from the old system into a new system that's kind of streaming forward? And Warner Brothers' big competitive advantage for years was a roster of great talent that continuously worked with them. And now there's talk of boycotts happening. So
yeah,
they're walking a very thin line, I think. And the other side of that is HBO Max, right, is supposed to be a new competitor to Netflix, right? And when I think of HBO, I think of it representing the very best in home entertainment. Like, that is their brand equity. Quick fact, HBO wins an Emmy for every $75 million it spends on content versus Amazon, which has to spend $400 million on content. Like, that's how good HBO is at this stuff. It's the studio behind The Wire, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Sex and the City, The Sopranos, like the very best of television. And now they seem to be treating it like just a dump of everything. Like, that premium content is now sitting beside Too Fast, Too Furious and The Big Bang Theory. You know,
I won't hear a bad word said about Too Fast, Too Furious in this podcast, Rory.
Well, I just think that they are very close to destroying the brand equity they have with HBO. And it's not even available on Roku. So this is a very slow car crash. This is like watching a very slow car crash. The theater side is another thing. Look, AMC is down 50% this year, but they're about down 90% from 2016. So they already had an awful lot of challenges, and there's a limited amount of sympathy I have with them. Like, why does the theater cinema industry not have to adapt like everyone else? Is the question I have for them. So yeah, look, don't invest in cinema stocks would be my the takeaway from that. And if you think HBO Max is really going to challenge Netflix, I'd think again.
Wow. That's a big statement. But just to your point there, like, Warner Brothers seemed fairly gung-ho with their decision here, but this isn't the first argument that's cropped up around this. There was, back in the summer, Universal had a big falling out with the likes of Regal Cinemas and AMC theatre chains over, they just basically said that, I think it was over the Trolls movie, was it?
Yeah, and AMC threatened to never show another Universal film again. Like, that was the most empty threat I've ever heard in my life. No, I'll drain by myself. Don't throw me the life raft. look, they're in trouble. They're in trouble, and the new CEO of Disney said famously a couple of months ago when asked this question, would they be bypassing the cinemas? He said, we're going to do what's right for our customers, and that, I think, he kind of said a lot in that sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's move on then and take a quick look at the things that are going on in My Wall Street at the minute. We published December Stock of the Month selection earlier this week. After a year of riding on the crest of some massive gains in technology stocks, including July's selection, which has almost trebled in value at time of recording, we've taken a different tack this month and go with a retail stalwart that still presents a great opportunity given the prevailing consumer trends. Don't forget that we'll also be publishing the Stock of the Month podcast on Monday, December 14th. This is an exclusive podcast for My Wall Street subscribers only, where Rory and I chat about the Stock of the Month selection in more depth and answer any questions you might have about it. If you're not a My Wall Street member yet but want to listen into this podcast, make sure to start your free trial of My Wall Street by using the link in the notes for today's show. Don't forget as well that the next podcast out in 2 weeks is the last podcast of 2020. This will actually be released on Saturday, December 26th, as opposed to Christmas Day, the 25th. So make sure to tune in as we review the year that was and make some of our big predictions for 2021. Guys, do you want to remind me what your predictions were for 2020? Emmett, what was yours?
I kind of took a safe enough bet. I think I said that we'd see one of the major bricks and mortar retailers go under, and I swear to God, I did not know that coronavirus is coming. So,
are you behind coronavirus? So,
yeah,
I refuse to even acknowledge that question. I'm either.
Rory, what was yours?
Something about Beyond Meat. I said they wouldn't do well. Looks like they have
been cut in half or something. Yeah. Well, yeah. We'll see. There's still about 3 weeks left in the year. Let's move on to Jargon Busters then. So, as I'm sure most of our listeners know, we're an Irish company. As such, we've got a lot of Irish listeners to this podcast. Recently, we got a question in asking about investing in ETFs in Ireland and the tax treatment surrounding this. Emmett.
Oh, thanks. Okay, well, right off the bat, I am not a tax advisor. I am not an expert in tax. All I know is I pay it every year and I pay all of it. So, but what I would say is that ETFs are taxed in a complex way here in Ireland. And it's very important to understand what you're getting into. In the US, if you buy an ETF exchange traded fund, it is treated as a straight up general equity. And therefore is kind of easy to reconcile at year end tax returns. But that's not so the case in Ireland, because when you buy an ETF in Ireland, their investor could be subject to capital gains tax at 33%, DIRT tax, as it's known, at 41%, or income tax at their own marginal rate, which I think is like 55%. So there are so many variables when you buy an ETF, and they're taxed depending on where they're domiciled, which really creates the complexity. So there's Irish domiciled ETFs. There's EU domiciled ETFs, which is ETFs other than Ireland. And then, of course, there's the US and other jurisdictions. And each one of those ETFs has its own tax profile. As far as I know, an Irish domiciled ETF has a 41% tax on exit, and an EU ETF is the same. You can see the complexity here. So yeah, you really exactly. need to know what you're buying. And it's a long and pretty boring subject. I could go on about it all day, but I'm not going to.
I know it's completely necessary, but I love the disclaimer you always give at the start of that, because it sounds like just the Revenue Commission is just listening in.
Everybody listens, don't they? Yeah. Everyone in Cayman Islands listens in. We're the number one, we're the number one podcast in the Cayman Islands, not just for business, for everything. So thank you. Thank you to everyone in the Cayman Islands. And we're the number one in where else, Rory?
Latvia.
Latvia, we're number one in Latvia, not just for business, for the whole shebang.
Shout out to our Latvian
thank you,
listeners.
People of Latvia, for the love.
Being in Latvia, was that the name of a band?
What I can see is in 10 years, there's going to be like a spike in Latvian billionaires because of our great advice.
There you go. Rory, I'm going to throw this next question over to you before we completely lose the run of this podcast. So you were asked about this on Twitter, but I'd love to hear your thoughts here on Callaway Golf as an investment.
Yeah, so Patrick Gilbert asked me this question on Twitter, and I was kind of bearish on the whole sector for a number of years in terms of golf, because one, I was under the impression that golf participation was in steady decline, but as is often the case, I was wrong. Patrick linked me to a great thread by Alan Sokloff, who really broke down a good opportunity in Callaway Golf, in particular this move towards casual golf through a company called Top Golf Entertainment, which I'd never heard of before, but which Callaway has just acquired. So I'm much more interested than I was in it than I was last week. I haven't had a chance to dig deep into the financials yet, but it looks like a lot of things are going well for it. Like, participation is on the rise. Young people are taking up the sport again. And there is a real business in the apparel, in golf apparel. So it's not going to be out to the app this month, but it's certainly piqued my interest. Take note, other Twitter followers, next time you want to pitch a business to me, follow Patrick's example, include a link to a great thread like the one he did for Alan's Breakdown, and you might get mentioned on the Stock Club podcast.
Don't just shout tickers at you. This last question is a really good question. I think it was actually Anne-Marie, one of the employees here at My Wall Street, that came up with it. And I'd love to hear both of your thoughts on this. So would you ever invest in a business that you don't like? So it might be a good investment opportunity, but you don't necessarily like the company. Emmett, I'll come to you first.
It would depend on the reason why I don't like it. So if I have a kind of a moral objection to what the business is doing or how they're going about business, no, I wouldn't. There's plenty of great investment opportunities. In fact, there's near infinite choice of opportunities of businesses that are fully aligned with my belief set and my own internal moral compass. So I kind of think the short answer is it depends. I would invest in a business I don't like if it was a cash machine and it was undervalued and I believed that there was an implicit value there that would be unlocked and it doesn't do anything that I have a particular objection to. So it's somewhere between maybe and yes and no.
What a clear and concise answer.
I pride myself on concise answers.
Rory, what about you? Somewhere between yes and maybe?
No, I'll be a bit more concise. I'll go with no. The word for amateur comes from the French word meaning to love. You know, it's to do something for the love of it rather than the fact that you're being paid for it. We're happy and we're lucky enough to be paid for what we do and we love what we do. And in a roundabout way, I suppose, like the amateur investor, is there such a thing as an amateur investor? Because they're hoping to make income from it at some point. But like, it's something you're doing in your spare time, researching businesses. You know, you're not being, you're not sitting at a desk doing it every day. Why bother with things you're not in love with? Why bother with companies that you don't like when there's so much opportunity out there? There's so many great businesses out there. Like you're not going to get every great investment. No investor's going to invest in every great company. You're going to miss some big ones over the years. You're never going to buy at the bottom and sell at the top. So stop worrying about that. Invest in companies you admire.
Yeah.
Like that's just much more fun. And that's what I would do if I wasn't doing it for a living. And that's what we kind of do in my Wall Street as well. We don't pick companies we don't really like. So yeah, that my answer would be a harsh no.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Let's move on to the elevator pitch then to finish out the podcast. So over the past few episodes, I've asked you guys to pitch me your favorite razor and blade company, your favorite pick and shovel company, your favorite land and expand company. Today, in celebration of our non-tech stock of the month pick, I want you guys to pick your favorite brick and mortar retailer of the moment. Rory, come to you first.
Yeah, I'm going to go with what I think is the best in class in terms of brick and mortar retail. It's Home Depot, the king of home improvements. I think a lot of people know this business just for the kind of the warehouse business where you go and you buy what did I call it last time, was it steel things? Someone remind
yeah
me. Luke's laughing here.
Home Depot sells a lot of really heavy things that aren't really very high price items, like tins of paint, metal for your gaff.
Yeah,
and so it's
you know, Dublin expression.
Yeah, sorry, that's a Dublin thing. Metal for your gaff.
Gaff equals house. Yeah. Our home.
Bricks and stuff. No, it's the place you go when you want to do some DIY in your home. But they've actually got a much bigger business behind it. They've got a MRO business, which is maintenance, repair, and operations, which provides everything to the kind of professional tradesmen like plumbers, electricians, janitors, and they've just got a great footprint, great mind share, great employees. The employees love working there. It's a great culture and a great business going forward. And I think the coronavirus is actually going to be a net benefit to them over the long term.
I'd like to point out that off air in my Wall Street, every time I've asked Rory or said to Rory that we should have Home Depot as stock of the month, I've been called boring and predictable. And so
that's true. That is true. I remember that.
I feel a bit vindicated now. Emmett, what's your favorite bricks and mortar retailer?
Well, it's the same kind of person who goes to Home Depot. And before I tell you my answer, I know that a few eyebrows will be raised from the My Wall Street membership base, and it's for Duluth Holdings. I like Duluth. And the reason eyebrows will be raised is it's currently in quarantine in our app. And the reason it's in quarantine is we put companies in there through a democratic process. Doesn't mean that all of us are always aligned at all points in time. Duluth Holdings, it kind of sells casual workwear. And the reason I like it is it's small. Its market cap is sub $400 million. It's profitable. It has its own front door out to fresh air for the most part. So these are standalone units where customers can pull up outside in their car and walk through the front door without entering a shopping mall, in turn making it a little bit more appealing for shoppers during the pandemic. But what I really most like about Duluth was I listened into the last conference call and I just thought the management team are remarkably lucid. They had an absolutely wonderful view of where they're going. They're not trying to grow at breakneck speed, but they're trying to grow very, very sensibly. So I like the business. And I think that for very long-term investors, $380 million business that's profitable in retail, selling apparel, which I generally have an aversion to, it's one I do like.
Yeah, there was a tough couple of years for Duluth, but they seem to have been recovering this year, despite the kind of other tailwinds or headwinds, I mean, that bricks and mortar stores were facing. So interesting pick. So that's it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget about all the great new stuff in the My Wall Street app at the moment. If there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode, please make sure to get in touch with us. You can find us on Twitter, that's at MyWallStreetHQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Please don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club too. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to us on. From the three of us here today, thanks for listening and happy investing. This episode of Stock Club is brought to you by Hyundai. Restart your journey towards a greener world with Hyundai's next generation of zero-emission cars. Find out more about their range of electric vehicles and the savings they can bring to your company and employees at Hyundai.ie.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.